next item on the agenda, item number 5, L. Scott Trainum, docket number 09-0806. Morning, sir.
Good morning. Mr. Bowman, members of the commission, good morning. This is the commission review and appeal of the February 11th, 2010 decision of the York County Wetlands Board to deny the request of Scott Trainum for a breakwater sill and revetment project in his property in York County. The project is located at 102 Creek Circle in the Seaford area of York County, more specifically in the York Point subdivision. York Point sits at the confluence of Cabin Creek, Chisholm Creek, Cosin River, which drain into the bay. We're just a little bit south of the mouth of the York River. And with the exception of these first two slides, the balance of the slides I will show you are all part of the record. The first two are just to orient you to the project area, and we don't consider that opening the record. The record's quite voluminous. You have it before you. There were three hearings, six PowerPoint presentations totaling 270 slides. I don't intend to show you 270 slides. I have pulled a subset that I think summarizes the issues.
All right, sir.
Mr. Trainum's property sits more specifically at the confluence of Cabin Creek and the Pocosin River. It is a vacant lot, bordered to the east by a man-made canal, to the south by the Pocosin River, to the north by Cabin Creek. This is an aerial photograph taken about a year ago. Here's your canal, Cosin River, Cabin Creek, and this is Chesapeake Bay out here. The property began what used to exist as a marsh. It was filled by the previous property owner years ago, until such time that the Corps of Engineers stopped them in the 70s. That property was required to carve out or remove some of the fill. That's why you see a marsh in the middle of the lot or towards its southern end. Mr. Trainum bought the property years later. This is the York Point subdivision, which also had its beginnings as a marsh and a creek until such time as they cut three canals through the marsh surface, side cast and material to make the buildable lots. Is Mr. Trainum's property here. So the entire area is low and subject to coastal flooding. This is the shoreline of Mr. Trainum's property. You see the construction debris pretty much spilling out of the banks. Concrete, brick, asphalt, and the occasional metal pipe. The unconsolidated nature of this material, fill material plus the lack of filter fabric plus just the inappropriateness of this as a shoreline treatment, has pretty much resulted in a chronic erosion of the shoreline that actually is a little bit more pronounced on the Pocosin River shoreline where you have greater fetch, wind tides, waves, energy. There's also some granite dumped out on the property again by the previous property owner. Subject of three hearings. The first hearing was held in October. Very long hearing, a number of speakers in opposition. Both the board and the protestants felt like the breakwater proposal was just too large a project for this shoreline. And at the end of a long hearing, the board asked the agent, Mr. Neville Reynolds, with the design firm of VHB, they would consider tabling the matter and bringing back a modified proposal that reduced the project in its scope. He agreed. The November hearing was blown out by NOR-IDA. The December hearing was brief because there were protest letters coming in at the 11th hour. The agent asked for time to consider the protest, with the final hearing held in February. During the course of the three hearings, the board considered all of its staff presentations along with the exhibits and testimony of Mr. Trainum, his agent, and 16 speakers in opposition. Mr. Reynolds, again, the agent, indicated that prior to putting the application together, they met on site with Virginia's Shoreline Erosion Advisory Service, as well as with representatives from BEMS's Shoreline Studies Program, as well as with the staff of the Wetlands Board. In all three cases, he was encouraged to pursue a living shoreline design for the Trainum property. Now, this is just an example of a marsh sill that is not the Trainum property. He went on to explain that his firm had designed 60 similar projects on the East Coast and provided construction oversight, and that the Living Shoreline Treatment did an adequate job of protecting the property and was in keeping with Virginia's best management practices for shoreline treatments. Other factors that went into the design, the existing hydrodynamic conditions of the tide range of 2.25 feet out there, storm surge elevations ranging from 4.5 to 7, almost 7 feet in elevation, from the 10-year storm right up to Isabel. The property is about +6 at the top of the existing construction debris revetment. There's a 2 to 2.5 mile fetch out of the south that hits the Cosin River shoreline of this property. And Mr. Reynolds indicated that in the if you had sustained winds of 30 to 40 miles an hour out of that direction, which is not uncommon for a coastal storm, a 5-foot wave could be generated, and that would be on top of the whatever storm surge elevation that you were witnessing. This is a photograph taken by the Watkins Board staff out to Nora, Idaho. The rack line is about +6 elevation. You can see that the water did get that high. If you go around to the Cabin Creek side, I think the slide's turned around, but on the Cabin Creek side, I saw rack tides 60 and 70 feet landward at the top of the bank, so a portion of the property was underwater during our item. The advisory assistance they got from Seas and VEMS in concert with existing hydrodynamic conditions resulted in this design. You have two breakwaters proposed with nourishment, marsh plantings, and dune and grass plantings. This again is the Cosin River shoreline. As you move over to Cabin Creek, you step down to three sills and a revetment here, with the sills being planted. The wave energy is less in Cabin Creek. The fetch is less, so they drop down to a sill. And then finally, a rock spur that ties into the revetment that's existing in the canal. And the purpose of this was explained to lock down the nourishment and to protect the canal. This was compared to a similar design that's currently under review by staff that will be before you in the near future. This is a small boat basin at VEMS. They're proposing breakwaters, nourishment, plantings, and again a rock spur to protect the mouth of their canal. This slide was put in there by the agent to illustrate the jurisdictionality of the project and this is the Cosin River shoreline. The Wetland Act defines the jurisdiction of the board as being between mean low and mean high water in the absence of tidal wetlands and vegetation, which is what you have in this cross section. So the wetlands that are at risk for this proposal, for this particular cross section, is the intertidal face of the broken concrete revetment. There is some marsh on the Cabin Creek side where the wave energy is a little less. Mr. Reynolds went on to point out, and if you look at the burnt orange, 18% of this project is proposed in tidal wetlands or within the jurisdiction of the Wetlands Board. 82% is proposed channel to mean low water, therefore in your jurisdiction. And then on the last slide, comparing and contrasting the breakwater versus the sill versus the revetment. And I believe it was his intention to show what these things look like when they're built. In the breakwater slide, you see that it's planted from the top of the bank all the way down to mean sea level. Plants simply don't survive below mean sea level from there to mean low water, so the entirety of the site's planted. The sill is planted right up behind the revetment, the marsh sill, excuse me, and then with the rock revetment, you typically have the rock face with no vegetation. The protestants are concerned, however, that this nourishment material, which is also a planting medium, will essentially be lost from behind the proposed structures and eventually show in the canal and the channels of the Cosin River and Cabin Creek. They argued that the erosion on this property is either not evident or minimal, and that all that is needed to protect this property is a rock revetment. And they also challenged the wave climate analysis that was prepared by BHB, specifically with reference to the coastal storms and the waves that might strike the Cosin River shoreline. VEMS and Seas are in somewhat disagreement with that position. The Seas report, and again, that's the Shoreline Erosion Advisory Service, in their May 11th letter, indicated that the existing rock rubble revetment is failing and needs to be replaced. Both BIMS and CS affirmed that erosion on the property is ongoing. And BIMS concluded that the current proposal with the breakwater and the marsh plantings is consistent with their preferred approach for shoreline treatments of moderate to high energy sandy shoreline. So in essence, BIMS is supporting the breakwater proposal that's being before you today.
Did I understand you to correct or to say that the specific design that's being employed at BIMS in that slide is
I would point you to this statement. The offshore breakwater with beach nourishment for the Pocosin River shoreline is consistent with preferred approach for moderate to high energy sandy shoreline. So they're referring to the breakwater that's proposed along the Pocosin River portion of the Tranum property.
I just want to make sure I was clear on that. Thank you.
Nevertheless, it was the board's direction to the agent to bring back a modified proposal. He did so at the February hearing. The breakwaters in this slide have been replaced with a sill. The sill is a little bit closer to shore. It's about 75 feet from the top of the existing bank to the back of the sill. They're lower in height, a little bit less nourishment material, but again, to be planted, this would be Peyton's marsh meadow grasses here, and then alternate flora right to the back of the sill. So he offered that proposal. The board still questioned why the sill had to be that distance offshore. There was some debate about past guidance from them indicating that you needed a 20 to 25 foot wide marsh. Mr. Reynolds pointed out in the cross section, this is right here, that what drives the distance of the sill or the breakwater offshore are the existing conditions on the property. They've shown that waves and water do get up to the plus 6 foot elevation, so you start nourishing at that elevation, and this is the slope you're looking for. And I'm not an expert. They had Scott Hardaway at the hearing. He was not called on, but essentially Mr. Reynolds indicated that based on the empirical observations of BIMS over the 20 to 25 years they've been looking at sills and breakwaters, this slope is the slope you're looking for to have a stable plan form behind the structure. If you bring the structures closer to shore, you steepen the slope and you make it an unstable design. If you do that, you then have to come back here and armor the top of the bank with a revetment and end up with two structures. And you end up with two structures and you lose that natural edge that they're seeking with the living shoreline design. The board still basically felt uncomfortable with this approach as well, asking would he like to table it again. This was into the third hearing, and at that point he said, I believe we have essentially designed the project we think is appropriate for Mr. Tranum's property, and you'll have to ask Mr. Reynolds, but because of the apparent lack of support for the sill, he said he would ask that the board act on the project as originally proposed, which is the plan B drawing that you have in front of you. A motion to deny this project passed unanimously with no rationale made for the motion. I will say that the board had previously gone around the table and debated the appropriateness of a living shoreline project for this property. And it was a general consensus that the fate of the planting medium or the beach nourishment material behind these structures was not guaranteed. They couldn't say for sure that it would or wouldn't stay. Some felt it would, some felt it might not. They weren't sure. And that was generally their concern, appeared to be based on the fate of the material potentially impacting the navigable channels. So I'd like to move on to my summary, leaving this slide up for now. Staff is sympathetic to the protestants' concerns over the project's potential to adversely impact the existing navigable channels. Other than photographs and testimony, however, they provided no specific evidence to support the objections related to the potential impacts of the channels. In an attempt to address these concerns, Mr. Reynolds documented his firm's design and construction oversight of over 60 projects completed on the East Coast. He further pointed out that numerous breakwater projects had been previously approved by the board in York County and constructed over a 10-year period. Two of these projects, David Cashy and Daniel Babcock, were permitted by the board as recent as 5 months ago, and within sight of Mr. Trainer's property. One of those is right here. Mr. Trainer's property is here. There's a breakwater, a spur, nourishment, and a revetment that was permitted by the board within 650 yards of this project, about 1,000 yards upriver. There's another, that would be the Babcock project, within, again, within sight of this property. Section 28.2.1302.10b of the code provides that the board shall grant the permit if all of the following criteria are met, that the public and private benefits outweigh the anticipated public and private detriments, that the development conforms with the standards prescribed in the Act and our guidelines, and that the activity does not violate the purposes and intent of this ordinance. Section 28.2.1302.10c states that if the board finds that any of these criteria are not met, the board shall deny the application, leaving the applicant leave to resubmit in modified form. Although the board suggested that the project's risk to the adjacent channels was unknown, they never expressly found that any of the three aforementioned criteria had not been met. Section 28.2.1308 of the code provides that the standards for the use and development of wetlands shall be concentrated in wetlands of lesser ecological significance, and that the wetlands of primary ecological significance shall not be altered. Although the project is proposed will impact the intertidal face of a rock rubble wetland, these wetlands are considered to be of lesser ecological value by VEMS, and their alteration is therefore not inconsistent with the aforementioned criteria. The guidelines further suggest that a shoreline protection strategy involving breakwaters or sills are normally justified only if active detrimental erosion exists. Although the erosion rate may be in question by the protestants, both VEMS and SEAS have affirmed that erosion is occurring. In Mr. Reynolds' opinion, relocating either structure closer to shore would result in an unstable slope, and that would require a backshore revetment or two structures. We're most concerned about the board's minimal treatment and discussion of the project's potential to impact tidal wetlands within their jurisdiction, either pro or con. It appears to staff that the basis for the denial rested primarily on impacts to subaqueous lands, areas that are within the commission's jurisdiction. After careful review of the record on this matter, we are of the opinion that the criteria for denial required by Section 28.2.1302.10c of the code have not been adequately set forth by the board. It appears that the board may have arbitrarily denied this breakwater and sill project given their history of supporting living shoreline projects and within sight of two recently approved breakwater projects. Accordingly, in light of no clear basis and rationale for denying the project based on its impact to tidal wetlands, staff recommends that the commission remand the matter to the board with specific instruction to amplify the record regarding the rationale for denial as it relates specifically to tidal wetland impacts. We further recommend that the commission clearly note in this case that the majority of this project lies outside of the board's jurisdiction, channel to mean low water, and that the protestants' concerns for potential adverse impacts to navigation are rightly a matter for commission jurisdiction pursuant to provisions of Section 28.2.1205 of the Code of Virginia.
Any questions, Mr. Owen? Mr. Robbins?
Thank you. Randy, I do have one question on the board's final action, and I think you spoke about some of the plan view drawings and the fact that there was a second set of amended plan view drawings that came forward, but I just want to make sure we're clear that what was voted on at the February hearing, the motion reads, Dr. Breed made a motion to deny application of to deny application 09-26, and the motion passed. Can you show us which plan view drawing that relates to? Is that the
Mr. Reynolds specifically asked that the act on the project that originally proposed, which would be this project, this design, and not the sill.
But the reaction, just to follow up on that, Mr. Chairman, the reaction of the board to the amended plan view drawings was essentially similar, was it not?
In the sense that they were no more comfortable with the modified proposal than they were with the original proposal.
Mr. Sherrick?
Let me just get that. So the engineering firm BHB, VIMS, and SEAS state that there is moderate erosion with as high as 6-plus feet of seas occurring in storm activity.
The VIMS and SEAS affirm that erosion is occurring. The 6-foot elevation is the elevation that is pretty much at the top of that revetment along the Pecosin River shoreline. The wetland staff did show the Norida had reached that elevation.
And did the Wetlands Board or the protestants supply any scientific or engineering data to refute any of the claims that, you know, erosion is occurring? Or is this mostly anecdotal and
the latter?
Not being familiar with the composition of the York County Wetlands Board, I guess I'm trying to find the, from an expertise perspective, you've had BIMS, C's, a number of reputable individuals make recommendations, number one, that, as I presume in reading the record, were basically not acceptable to the board. Is that correct?
Yeah, the BIMS report supports the project along the Pecosin River shoreline. They did call into question sills versus just planting the Cabinet Creek shoreline, but in the end, I think it was the lack of discussion by the board regarding impacts of tidal wetlands that is the most concerned to staff. They talked a lot about the sand that is proposed as the planting medium behind these structures entering the navigable channels and not being sure where that material would wind up, but they really did not address the BIMS comments, nor did they address the project's potential impact tidal wetlands.
Okay. You showed on the overview of the property a number of similar projects that have apparently been approved in recent years that were designed similar to.
I can only say that the only project I pointed to that was approved by the board is this one here. There's one up the creek. The other slides were examples of living shorelines that have been offered as what they would look like if completed and planted by the design firm.
Okay. My question is this. Were you involved in the evaluation of this project that
yes.
was approved?
Yes.
You were?
I attended that hearing, and of course it was approved by this agency as well.
What type of criteria was considered by the Wetlands Board during the development of this project?
Well,
that would be different.
Well, in all honesty, you know, this is the Chesapeake Bay, and you've got a northeast strike. This is the Cozumel River, and you have a southeast to southwest
okay.
strike. This house was about to go in the bay. That would be the difference, you know. But the one up creek, you know, which is further up creek, you know, they've approved a breakwater and a sill. They've approved other breakwater projects around the county.
Trying to reconcile in my mind what the difference is, but anyway, maybe it may come out. Any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Trainum, President or Representative? Counsel, for the record, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission. For your record, my name is John Daniel, partner with the law firm of Troutman Sanders in Richmond and Virginia Beach. Good to see you all again. I trust everyone as well. I appreciate the opportunity to appear this morning on behalf of Mr. and Mrs. Scott Trainum. Mr. Trainum is here, as is Neville Reynolds. Mr. Trainum is the CEO of Innovative Communications in Newport News. And he and his wife own a lot, in York County, on which they desire to build a home. The dwelling, the location, the local approvals, including Chesapeake Bay Preservation Act compliance, have all been granted at the local level. And as I indicated, Mr. Neville Reynolds, senior project engineer with BHB, is here, as you heard in Randy's presentation. Mr. Reynolds has been responsible for providing the design and the engineering assistance to Mr. Trainum with regard to the shoreline stabilization and habitat improvement, and frankly, the establishment of a living shoreline for the home site. Mr. Trainum has chosen to incorporate the latest in green technologies, if you will, and attributes in the construction of his residence and in the shoreline protection design and habitat improvement mechanisms he's chose to employ. Just as a curiosity, the residence meets the most advanced of LEED standards construction. It incorporates grass roofing. It has cisterns which collect rainwater for purposes of irrigation on the property and other environmentally conscious state-of-the-art technologies. It is advanced technology, and it also is the lifestyle that Mr. and Ms. Trainum have chosen. In that same vein, the choice of his shoreline stabilization that incorporates habitat improvement and vegetated shorelines represents the latest in technologies to achieve the maximum protections and approximate as closely as possible the natural environment. Mr. Owen has accurately provided to you the project overview and familiarized you with the precise location of the project, of the property, and the design. Mr. Reynolds, as I've indicated, is here, and I don't think we'll add anything to Randy's comments at this time, but in the event that there are technical questions, he would be your guy. The overall scope of the project includes breakwaters, beach nourishment, sill and wetland terraining, revetment, supplementing existing riprap, if you can call what's presently there, riprap. In short, what Mr. Trainum seeks and what Mr. Reynolds has designed is a state-of-the-art living shoreline. That living shoreline serves multiple functions by protecting already eroding property from further degradation, by creating wetlands, which in turn establish habitat, and which in turn guard against flooding. The concept of living shorelines is not new to this commission. As you heard in Randy's presentations, your science advisor, Vims, have advised you on the attributes. You yourselves have studied the attributes of these shorelines. And in the field, your staff, I'll tell you, is very quick to applaud the virtues of projects incorporating that type of design. Simply as a point of interest, that precise design that is sought by Mr. Trainum for his lot in York County is, in fact, to be used at the VIMS campus in Gloucester Point as a means of employing the latest scientific technology to protect both the east and the west campus shorelines and the sizable aquaculture and other investments which are pertinent to the campus. Mr. Trainum appears to you today on appeal from the York County Wetland Board. The matter was first discussed in October of 2009, where it was tabled. It was heard again in December of 2009 and tabled, and heard once again in February 2010. And at that meeting, the application was denied by a 5-0 vote, which gives rise to this appeal to the commission. Curiously, in all three discussions before the board, the composition of the board was different. Nonetheless, the jurisdiction or the power of the local wetlands board is derived from the statutorily set forth model local ordinance at 28.2-1302. York County has adopted the ordinance as chapter 23.1 through 23.123 of the York County Code. The local ordinance sets forth permissible activities and requires a permit for certain activities within wetlands. Among the criteria is an analysis of conformance with guidelines issued by the commission pursuant to 28.2.1308. The model statutory ordinance is section 10B in the Virginia Code. And if you have the York County ordinance, which you're following, it's 23.111(c). And that section says in both cases, quote, the board shall grant the permit if all of the criteria are met, end quote, goes on to list three criteria. Those three criteria being, one, the anticipated public and private benefit of the proposed activity exceeds its anticipated public and private detriment. Two, the proposed development conforms with standards of 28.2-1308 and the guidelines promulgated pursuant to 1301. And thirdly, the activity does not violate the intent of the ordinance. With regard to the public-private benefits analysis or criteria one under which the board shall grant the permit, The issue is not how many people favored the project and how many people may have opposed the project. Rather, the analysis is to measure the natural resource value of the attributes of the project to the Commonwealth and our citizens. Put quite simply, the question is, in terms of the environment, and specifically wetlands, since it's a wetlands ordinance, what is the better course for the environment? Well, let's take a look. This project creates wetlands. It creates 6,800 square feet of non-vegetated wetland on the beach face. It creates an additional 4,000 square feet of vegetated wetlands, and it creates 19,000 square feet of backshore dune habitat. All of that is consistent with the long-established policies of the Commonwealth and our rules and regulations to establish wetlands in the circumstance as opposed to destroy wetlands. Further, the project avoids a hardened shoreline and the displacement of energy to off-site impacts, achieving yet another natural resource goal. The project creates marine habitat, once again consistent with long-standing goals of this Commonwealth. And the project follows the preferred approach of VIMS generally and specifically to this project by utilizing vegetation to maintain and to reestablish the estuarine environment. Likewise, as you heard before, it is the preferred approach of SEAS, or the Shoreline Erosion Advisory Service, which was consulted early on this project. If one were simply to keep score in terms of individuals supporting or opposed, or who showed up on a given night or a given afternoon or a given morning in a given place, the score in this case might be 12-2. And the board, the local board, may just have gotten it right. But on this point, they fell short. The test of the statute and the test of the ordinance is not an election. It's a holistic environmental analysis. So consider, not a single protestant or board member took issue with the environmental or longstanding policies of the Commonwealth that this project meets and achieves, and which I referenced to you a moment ago. Those are the public benefits, and they outweigh any detriments in any record before you from the local wetland board. Turning to the second criteria, the wetland guidelines. In Section 10 and 23.1-11C of the York Ordinance, wherein approval is mandated, the Commission promulgated guidelines. Section 4 of the Guidelines Manual indicates that under certain circumstances, construction of shoreline facilities may be justified in order to, quote, protect property from damage or loss due to erosion or other natural causes, end quote. In this case, there's clearly shoreline erosion, and it's becoming increasingly worse with time. The guidelines permit, and they specifically suggest, that shoreline strategies can be utilized. They go on to suggest that the planting of marsh grasses, as an example, is a preferred method. In this case, Mr. Trainum has been true to the guidelines. The guidelines have been taken into consideration as the project was engineered, and he desires a living shoreline for the many reasons previously discussed. In fact, many protestants argue that repairing the bulkhead is an acceptable course. One board member indicates, quote, I'm always in favor of a living shoreline approach, and I would not like to see the whole property edged with riprap, end quote. A second agreed with that comment, and another suggested creating a living shoreline in stages may be the way to go. A fourth member applauds the concept of living shorelines, and another advocates protecting wetlands. Perfect. This project creates, as I indicated to you, almost 30,000 square feet of wetland. While there was more discussion among the board, according to the minute, it appears that 5 of 5 had no disagreement that stabilization was acceptable and that some component of a living shoreline was acceptable. So given that, it's hard to believe or conceive that criteria 2 of the ordinance has not been met. I think it's then in turn pretty easy to conclude that the third criteria of the statutory ordinance, the ordinance which mandates approval should all three criteria be met, that the activity does not violate the purposes and intent of the ordinance, for they are also met. Under that analysis, the board had no choice in this case. And the implementing statute, the model ordinance, the York County ordinance is clear when it says the board shall grant the permit. Turning now to a second and perhaps paramount discussion. And that's the issue of whether or not this local board exceeded its jurisdiction in denying the application. Specifically, did the board consider factors beyond their jurisdiction to justify denial of the project? Now, as most of you know, I have the highest respect for citizen boards and for public service. I've done it for a long time, and I've always applauded, whether I agreed or disagreed with individuals who serve, I've applauded their service, and I do so here. But I know how difficult it can be when tasked with implementing a regulation or a statute to stick to the very narrow scope, authority, and purport of that statute. But it's paramount that local boards and individual citizen boards do so. It's the system we use, whether good or for bad, it is our system. And we use it to protect vital and important natural resources and to tap citizens at the local level to assist in that process. In this case, we have a clear example of a group of caring, considered public servants trying their very best who simply appeared to get carried away with the rhetoric of the moment at a hearing. The only jurisdiction that could be exercised in this case is what is proposed by the applicant is that area located between the mean high and the mean low watermark. That's it. It's no more, it's no less. Those components of this project, below mean low water, remain the purview of this commission, those features which sit in the subaqueous bottom. And hopefully this commission will have the opportunity to consider those elements at a later date. Consider, in order to make my point regarding excessive reach, the minutes of the February 11th meeting of the York County Wetland Board. Speaker after speaker discussed the scope of the project as being too large, referencing the structures to be placed beyond mean low water. Many indicated sand drift would be a problem. The shoaling would occur, the channels would be impeded, the navigation would be blocked, all perhaps appropriate concerns and ones that will ultimately be addressed. But by this commission, as you consider this matter, pursuant to 28.2-1203 for a subaqueous permit. Those are not issues within the purview of a local wetlands board. And more importantly, the comments of the board members, as represented in the February 11 minutes of the local wetland board meeting of that date, quote, "I think the project is too large." Strong disagreement by one with Mr. Reynolds' assertion at that meeting that the local board jurisdiction over the structures was outside the board's purview. Another board member expressed concern for the long-term monitoring of breakwaters. And another, quote, "This is not a place to create a beach or a dune," referencing the structures and the success and failure. And finally, quote, "We cannot predict what impacts this project will have on the surrounding area. The channels and the canals must stay open," end quote. Once again, the board comments clearly are indicative of considerations beyond the scope, beyond the jurisdiction of a local wetlands board. And they exceeded that jurisdiction in this case. And while you may have some appreciation for their desire to delve into your domain, you may even want them to in some cases, they simply are not authorized to do that, and that is ultimately your responsibilities as you sit on this commission. You and you alone can make the decisions with regard to the bulk of the issues in this case. Finally, with regard to the action you will take today, I'm appreciative very much of the staff recommendation and the hard work of Mr. Owens in this case. It's been a long haul, as they say, and I do appreciate the recommendation that this matter be remanded to the local wetland board. I think that recommendation in and of itself implies from your staff's concern that the local board erred in some regard. you are, of course, entitled, and I would ask you to do so, to reverse the decision of the local wetlands board. The controlling statute for you this morning is 28.2.13.13, which provides you with latitude as to how you respond to an appeal from a local wetland board. If this were a situation where only one of the enumerated bases for action had been violated, I might very well concur that the appropriate course would be remand. However, in this case, there are multiple flaws under 1313 that prejudice the rights of Mr. Trainum and the result that has been achieved. The local decision was clearly in excess of statutory authority and jurisdiction of the board. The decision was based on an unlawful procedure. The decision was unsupported in whole by the relevant evidence on the record, and the decision was arbitrary in that this is the lone single project since 1998, and Randy gave you references to two. The lone project in the last decade that's been considered by this board that involved groins and breakwaters that has not been approved. For those reasons, and the more pragmatic one, that it's doubtful that the result would be any different. The projects received negative discussions on three separate occasions at three lengthy hearings on three different dates at the local level. I would ask that you seriously consider reversing the decision of the York County Wetland Board this morning. Allow Mr. Trainum to move forward. He's been in this government loop on this project for almost two and a half years now. It's simply time to allow this environmentally conscious and state-of-the-art project to move forward. Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to answer any questions members of the commission or reflect them to Mr. Reynolds should they be of a technical nature.
Any questions of Mr. Daniel by members of the commission?
I have a Mr. Reynolds technical question.
A technical question?
Yes.
I'm not your guy.
So I'm just going to test and let you give me the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do.
State your name for the record, please.
Neville Reynolds.
Mr. Schick, proceed.
In the minutes, the Wetlands Board had made a brief discussion about possibly just riprapping the property as opposed to a living shoreline, hardening the shoreline. And although I have a background in coastal geography, I'm by no sense am I an engineer. So, but I'm to understand that would actually increase the energy and possibly cause more sediment from wave action than the living shoreline provides. Is that correct? And
well, the living shoreline approach is certainly a more dissipative land-water interface, or offensive structure, as opposed to a revetment, which would be more of a defensive structure. It's on a much steeper slope. Wave action strikes it and is reflected off of that slope, so there generally is an increased energy level in front of those structures, as opposed to a beach face or a marsh surface, which allows the wave to run across it and dissipate the energy over a more gradual 10-to-1 slope, as opposed to a 1.5 or 2-to-1 slope on a revetment,
which in turn then could cause problems being reflected off to other areas in the area of this project. Is that
it? Could, yes.
As opposed to absorbing the energy and keeping that energy localized, as opposed to having it go into channels and other.
There is that benefit. I think with these structures on the Pocosin River, the likelihood of that reflection causing real problems to adjacent properties is probably not high. But again, in the grand scheme of shore protection and the options that are available, we have generally leaned towards a more natural approach, a more dissipative edge, as opposed to a hardened edge.
Further questions? Mr. Tankard.
I have a question for Mr. Daniels, please, if I could. Mr. Daniels, you asked that we reverse, and when we look at 28.2.13-1313, you're saying we should reverse again. I'm a little slow this morning, perhaps, so if you would repeat
that.
Why you think we should reverse.
Well, I think when you look at 1313, what I said was that that section and you're looking at it gives you latitude. It also lists a number of issues that you can either choose to remand, reverse, or affirm. My comment was that if only one of those items in that litany under 2A through F, if only one of those were present, then I could understand that a remand might be in order. But if you look at that, those items A through F are listed in the disjunctive, not the conjunctive. So you don't have to find all of them. It's an or. My comment was that given the fact that multiple of those elements can be found in this case, and I realize you haven't heard from protestants and you will hear from them, but in our review, I think, and frankly Randy's staff recommendation will tell you that a number of those enumerated items that are listed in the disjunctive are present, and given the magnitude of those items and the fact that this matter has already been heard three times at the local level, my request to you was that it's fairly severe. It's time for Mr. Trainum to be able to move on with this project, and for that reason I seek your concurrence to reverse the local decision.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Daniels.
Thank you.
Did you have anyone else that wanted to speak before I hear from you?
No. I would like to reserve a few minutes. Mr. Trainum is here, and he may want to make a comment during our brief rebuttal period, if you would allow us one.
Is the Wetlands Board here represented?
Yes.
Morning, sir.
Yes.
You saw this for the testimony that you'll give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do.
State your name for the record.
My name is James Barnett. I'm the county attorney for York County, also with us.
Mr. Barnett, I did not know you were counsel. So.
That's fine. I don't mind being sworn in. I honor the process.
Thank you.
Also with me today, by the way, is Anna Drake, who has served as a primary staff liaison to this board. And provides it its technical expertise to the extent that, you know, that it's available. Let me address one issue just right off the bat. And the comment has been made that this board exceeded its jurisdiction because it looked at matters that went beyond the mean low water line. And let me cite to you an attorney general's opinion from 1984 from Gerald L. Belisles, then the attorney general, to the Honorable William A. Pruitt, Commissioner, Marine Resources Commission. And the question was slightly different. It had to do with a groin, which in a project extended out beyond the jurisdictional line. Excuse me. And the question was, could they consider the length of the groin? And then Attorney General Belisle said, in part, I conclude that a local wetlands board should consider the impact on wetlands from the total project, including that portion of the project resting on subaqueous lands beyond the wetland, although not expressly authorized to do so by statute. Regulation of the length of a structure is vital to exercising the authority to regulate the use of wetlands. I think that is self-explanatory. I believe that a local board is, in fact, obligated to look at a project as a whole. It cannot, in fact, parcel it up and say, we're only going to think about this project to where a line is drawn, and the rest of it will ignore. I understand that that causes overlap between jurisdictions of the two boards. I think, however, that that is essential. You simply have to allow local boards to look at the entire project. Otherwise, they simply just can't do their jobs. So I no more on that point. I think it's fairly clear. So I think if you did not, in fact, go beyond their jurisdiction in looking at the project as a whole. In looking at the statutory and the ordinance, which, by the way, parallel one another, of course, because localities are told word for word how to adopt an ordinance, there are two things I want to draw your attention to. And And before I do that, let me say this. There really is no question about whether the living shoreline approach is within guidelines and is allowed. It certainly is. The question is whether it's appropriate for this parcel. It should not matter whether or not other projects have been approved or are currently being proposed using this approach. The question, again, is it correct here, in spite of, you know, when you take everything into account? Two things, both in ordinance and in statute. And what I'm looking at right now is, in fact, York County Ordinance 23.1-11, which mirrors Code 28.2-1302. That in making its decision whether to grant or grant in modified form or deny, etc., an application, the board shall consider the following, and there are three things. And one is, such matters raised through the testimony of any person in support of or in opposition to the permit application. So a public hearing, and this is really what is being referred to here, obviously, is essential. Public input is essential. That is not to say that the York County Wetlands Board simply counted noses. I don't believe that they did. They don't have a history of doing that, and I don't think that's what happened in this case. But there was substantial citizen opposition to what was going to happen to the sand placed inside these wetlands and you know, the jurisdictional line, and also outside, and what was going to happen to it. And the board shall grant the permit if all the following criteria are met. Now, I'm not going to concentrate on 2 and 3, whether it's within the guidelines to allow it. It is, obviously. And whether or not it violates the purposes or intent of this chapter, which is maybe a little more dicey. But let me concentrate on the first one, both in code and in ordinance. The anticipated public and private benefit of the proposed activity must exceed its anticipated public and private detriment. If it does not, then items 2 and 3 become irrelevant, because all three of those questions must be answered in the affirmative if the permit is to be granted. The public benefit, a public or private benefit, must exceed the detriment. And then again, there are the issues of whether or not it complies with guidelines and intent and so forth. The testimony was to the effect that given this, the expected environmental pressures on this particular piece of property, there was serious question about what was going to happen to the sand. And yes, obviously a lot of the discussion was, is it going to end up in the channels? But I think that's a fairly serious question, and one that wetlands boards, looking at the project as a whole, should be entitled to look at. Secondly, the Wetlands Board had before it testimony of people who live out there. Now, the question is, do they have scientific evidence? In the normal flow of things, it's going to be the applicant who's going to have the consultant who has, you know, what you might consider scientific evidence. Other than that, the board will rely on its own expertise and expertise of staff. And let me point out that I'm advised that two of our Wetlands Board members actually have PhDs in marine science, I believe is the case, and that's Dr. Frisch and Dr. Jan Brede, is how his name is pronounced. So there is expertise, actually, as a matter of fact. But there's also the testimony of individuals who live there and have been there when storms have hit, and they are some of the protestants who came and spoke and said they know what happens out there when there's a storm. This is not necessarily as moderate as some people want to say, and there are large storms that hit there. In fact, one of the other applications that have been approved at the very point of land down there at the bottom of the photograph, there's reference to the Cashy application, previously approved, also for a living shoreline approach. On page 5 of the minutes of the latest meeting, the one this year, you'll see one individual who mentioned that specific piece of property, the Cashy property, which, in fact, though a living shoreline, lost substantial amounts of sand in recent storms and had to be replaced. There was also a reference to a similar project in Yorktown itself, which has had to suffer the need for a rather constant sand replacement. Maybe constant overstates it, but there has been periodic need for due sand replacement on a project much like this and approved under much the same kind of criteria. So actual experience. And these people who were giving this testimony don't have their own PhDs, I don't think. If so, they didn't say. But that's an effective counterbalance to someone saying, I've done plans, I've done drawings, as opposed to what happens in the real world out there. So those are primarily the criteria that the board looked at. And in fact, they considered, as they were obligated to, opinions pro and con. And they looked at the anticipated benefit and asked themselves, what's happened in the past? We've approved some. They haven't always worked the way that they, we were told they were going to. And of course, every property is different. And you really have to look at them individually. And that's primarily it. I'm sorry, I can't be more long-winded than that. I'm happy to answer any questions if you have them. And for technical questions, I will again defer to my to staff, Ms. Drake.
Mr. Schick? Could you please read Mr. Belisle's reference to...
I have the entire...
If you could.
Do you want me to read it in its entirety into the record?
The part that you read us.
In fact, I'll go just a sentence in front of that. By the way, let me read first of the initial paragraph as to what the question was. That might be helpful to you. You have requested my opinion regarding the authority of a local wetlands board to regulate the length of structures known as groins, parenthesis, structures built out from the shore to prevent erosion, in parenthesis, and other similar structures constructed as part of a single project extending beyond the wetlands in both the intertidal zone and below mean low water. And then this paragraph. By reading a wetland board's authority to carry out the Commonwealth's strong policy favoring wetlands preservation, together with the deference to the Wetlands Act decisions contained in then 62.1-3, I conclude that a local wetlands board should consider the impact on wetlands from the total project, including that portion of the project resting on subaqueous lands beyond the wetland, although not expressly authorized to do so by statute. Regulation of the length of a structure is vital to exercising the authority to regulate the use of wetlands. Now, this is not specifically limited to length of structure, but I think by analogy, it should answer the question of whether or not the board has exceeded its authority to consider the project as a whole. And I think, frankly, that the mental gymnastics that would be required to look at a project like this and say we were only going to think about that part between mean low water and the 1.5 times tidal range, you know, that's ours. It doesn't make any sense. A wetlands board can't do its job if that's what it restricts itself in doing.
So my understanding of his statement there is that the wetlands board can look at the entire project as it affects the wetlands that it has its purview. Not to aqueous lands, but only as it affects wetlands. Is that correct?
Well, that was the question. I will let you have your own read of it. I don't read it, and I understand what you're saying. The question being, did the local board look specifically at the effect on wetlands? And I understand that they did not pass a resolution saying we are disapproving this application because that sand might destroy wetlands. I think that's rather assumed in their comments. Obviously, a lot of what they said and what the citizens said looked at what's going to happen to the channel. And there's just no escaping that. That's what a lot of people talked about.
Okay.
And if the issue is, just to address whether or not this should be overturned or remanded, or actually I would urge you to simply to support it and to uphold that decision, then I would prefer that it be sent back. Because if you think that the board did not look at the right thing or include some magic phrase, i.e., sand might move everywhere, and by the way, that may also adversely impact wetlands, then send it back to them and have them say that. But frankly, I think that almost can be assumed. Their concern is what's going to happen to the project. Is it going to work? And if it doesn't, what bad things can happen? And their decision was the public potential detriment, in their view, outweighed the private benefit, particularly when there were other things available, i.e., hardscape the entire surface, the entire perimeter, or, as they had asked repeatedly, something reduced. Now, I can only put myself in their minds, you know, without asking them, unfortunately. I had anticipated, frankly, maybe what they meant by a reduced project was keep your new sand as far away from the channel as possible, but maybe I'm wrong in what their assumption was. But that's not what happened. The new plan came back looking almost exactly like the old one. But anyway, they made their decision, and I think it's supportable. I would prefer that it be remanded rather than overturned, because if you think that they didn't ask the right questions, then they are the people to ask that question, I would think. Anyway, those are my comments.
Other questions? Mr. Tankard.
I'm certainly sympathetic to the testimony of folks in the area, and you mentioned that they said often and repeatedly that there was sand that was replaced in the Cashy project. But unless I'm missing something, they don't refer to the sand moving into canals or anything of that nature, waterways, channels, etc.
I'm not.
I'm sorry.
I think you're correct on that. I'm not sure that they did.
The Cashy project and contractor here was not re-nourished. The material was lost in the days of property line.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Well, I might just want to make sure that to make sure I understood the testimony clearly, there was no discussion of sand in the channels, waterways, inlet, et cetera.
Actually, looking at the testimony of Anthony Bavusa, who spoke, and this is on page 5 of the February 11 minutes. So he's right in the middle of the page there. He mentions the Cashy property. I think actually, in his case, he's actually talking about the Yorktown property and talks about his speculation that because Yorktown also had to replace sand, that other properties in his area would... He didn't actually even address specifically even the channel. It was a Ted Hemmert whose comments begin at the bottom of that page. I think he's the one who spoke directly about, Mr. Cashy is my neighbor, and was 6 months after his project was complete, we lost 35 feet of our property, actually, he said. So I don't think he addressed either specifically the channel. So not everyone who spoke actually spoke directly to the issue of clogging channels. It was a major concern, but certainly wasn't the only thing that citizens talked about.
Mr. Tanker?
Just to make myself clear, but there was no testimony towards the experience of sand clogging channels.
No, I don't believe that there was, actually, no. I mean, no one, that is to say, said that they actually had experience with, not that I recall anyway, and if there was, then I'll apologize for having missed it. But in this last hearing, I don't recall anything to that effect.
I guess the only concern I've got, you made the comment that each project is an individual project and should be judged on its individual merits. And looking at the topography we have there, I can understand why you would feel that way. However, it gets to a point where in evaluating overall fairness, whether a decision is arbitrary, I would not say that it's capricious at all, but arbitrary, you have to take into consideration past history and past experience, I think. I think the rule of law is based on that. And in this situation, you have similar designs in close proximity. I do understand one's on this side of the bay and one's at the other side and those things, but at the same time, when you've got a report from the Virginia Institute of Marine Science which says it's acceptable way of doing business, and then you've got a couple of board members who, of course, utilize their expertise, I'm kind of wondering where the breakpoint is, where the advice that you get, you take, under what circumstances. When is it good advice? When is it bad advice? And when is it appropriate to basically supplant how they feel, either from an anecdotal perspective or from based on their knowledge? And I'm just a little concerned in this situation that we have a number of respected entities supporting this project, entities that we rely on from time to time, and the matter was denied without a whole lot of dialogue as to why. Quite honestly, I read the minutes, and when it got to the end of the minutes, I thought I was missing a page, because it goes from looking like things are working toward some type of resolution, and then the motion is made and out the door it goes. I wasn't at the meeting, of course, but that's kind of the idea that I'm getting. I'd like to hear your
feedback on that. And I understand that. There had been a request earlier, actually at the initial hearing, I believe, please come back with a modified project. We will be much more favorable, I think was the implication anyway. We would like to look at something reduced in scope. And then what came back to them was something with very minor modifications. It still showed essentially the same project in the same location. The board became involved in a discussion as to whether or not the groins should be placed or the breakwaters closer to the shore. And that's a technical question I'm not prepared to address, and there was some technical discussion. And the question was asked, essentially, if I recall how it went, because I was there, would you be willing, in fact, to come back with something more modified? And then there was discussion among the board members what instructions would we give him to try to meet if, in fact, you know, he wants to come back. And then someone asked, let's find out first whether or not he will even consider coming back with something modified, or does he want an up-and-down vote? And the applicant said, we prefer an up-and-down vote right now on what we've given you. We would rather than come back with yet another iteration of this plan. And that's why things maybe at the end look like they happened very quickly. Because there was discussion, which was, I think the board was trying to get some ideas across. But then the applicant said, basically, you know, please up or down, and if I have to, I'll appeal. And I don't know if he said that there or after the meeting broke up, but I mean, in a friendly fashion. But we all suddenly understood that, you know, further discussion of further direction, et cetera, was not what the applicant wished. So things did some kind of sort of an abrupt end if you're just reading the minutes.
Can I get the citation for the AG's opinion that you referenced?
Yes, actually. It's, excuse me. It is. Yeah, I can give you both sites. 1984-1985, Attorney General, page 448. Or, if you're on Lexis, it's 1984, Virginia, AG Lexis, 199. Decided October 31, 1984. And I am not aware of anything, at least, that reversed that.
Further questions, gentlemen? Thank you. Who we have next?
Ms. Drake is here, if really to answer technical questions, if there are any. A hand was being raised here.
I have
Dr. McConaughey?
Could we see the original proposal and the modified proposal? I'm just curious as to how much modification was made.
That is the original proposal that they acted on and denied. And pay attention to the modification is to replace this shoreline as proposed, that was offered, and then withdrawn with a sill design. So here's your Pecosin River shoreline, the rock spur. I'd have to ask Mr. Reynolds to elaborate on the design changes, but instead of breakwaters, you have sills and I think a reduced spur. And this distance offshore changes because mm-hmm. they're lower height structures, and your slope brings them closer to shore.
In your opinion, would that be just a very minor modification from the original proposal?
Not if you got a 5-foot wave coming at you, but it pulled the structure in, I want to say 30 to 40 feet, and I don't know the cubic yards of material they could tell you, but it was a significant reduction in the amount of material that would be nourished behind it.
Further questions?
Thank you.
Is there anyone here in opposition to the project that was at the Wetlands Board meeting that wishes to speak? Okay. This is what we'll do. I need you to all stand. Raise your right hands. Solemnly swear the testimony you give be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God. Thank you. Two rules, if you would. The testimony that you'll provide today must be the same testimony that you had at the Wetlands Board, and I'll ask you to be brief because of the time involved. So who's first?
I'd like to go first.
Come forward, sir. Randy, if we stray from what your recollection were, I need you to let me know. Please constrain it to what you said at the Wetlands Board meeting.
Could you put the aerial photo up?
Sure. Right there. That's the one. No, I'm sorry. The one that was looking down more at the one that was up through most of the presentation. Yeah. There it is right there. Yeah, that's great. Thanks.
State your name for the record, please, sir.
Gary Winthrop Van Tassel. I reside at 102 York Point Drive, Seaford, in the York Point development. I'll spend a few minutes. I think this works somehow.
It does.
Yeah, there we go. I just spent a couple of minutes to introduce myself to you. I'm a dual licensed graduate of the United States Merchant Marine Academy. I hold a Master of Engineering degree in Ocean Engineering from Stevens Institute of Technology. I hold a Master's license of Master Sail. I hold a Master's license of Master Steam and Motor Vessels, and I hold an Unlimited Engineer's license. I'm a practicing naval architect and marine engineer, and I've spent the better part of my career, some 35 years now, on the water, about the water, and for the water, and I've been involved in many, many terminal development projects and have dealt with sediment transfer and wind and waves over the substantial part of my career. I also happen to be a resident of the area. So I say that to tell you that I have a little bit of expertise in these matters, not just as a resident who is in pure opposition to it. To answer Mr. Tankard's question, just to put it in perspective, this is my property right here. Since this has been built here, over this past winter, I have built and added about 1 foot to a foot and a half of sand in my property. Can I tell you that that's absolutely because of this? Certainly I can't, because we don't have those kinds of studies, those kinds of data, that kind of engineering sensors out there. But I can tell you that we have had major sand buildup, so there is sand transport that is taking place in the area. I don't live on these properties, so I can't make any statements as to what happens there. There has been, and in my letter of opposition, in my testimony, I talked about the weather conditions and such that can be found in this area. And this is north. My property sits almost aligned, almost directly north-south. From the northeast, there is no doubt that we have substantial, and I would say heavy to moderate, and lean on the heavy, potential wave actions and storm surges that come in. We regularly see 50, 60 knot winds out of this area, and if a hurricane comes through, we can see 75, 80, 85 mile an hour winds. And I've weathered now three of those level storms. Norida brought water to my garage door. So I'm, you know, quite familiar with the kind of sea conditions we get. Certainly there's no question that we can see, quote-unquote, five-foot seas out in that area. There has been said this morning that the fetch down in this area is about 2.5 miles. I would dispute that. I know a little bit about navigation, and I checked the charts the other day and measured it out. It's actually about 1.8 miles over a water depth of 5 to 10 feet of water. So it's entirely very sheltered. From the northeast, from the heavy sea conditions, this property sees nothing. From the northwest, from these conditions, and even the Cabin Creek side, this property sees nothing in terms of wave action. Now, I would draw your attention to the fact that I'm 6'1". A 5 foot wave is a substantial height against me. And when we talk about significant wave height in engineering sense, we're talking about generally what is called H1/3 wave heights. That means that 1/3 of those waves will be higher than 5 feet, 2/3 of those waves will be lower than 5 feet. And these are random events, as anybody's been on the water knows. They're not, you know, uniform sinusoidal waves. When you have shallow water depths like this, the wave action switches from being a trapezoidal, where the water particles move in a circular fashion, to an influence at the bottom, where the wave particles move in an elliptical fashion. In order to get in 35 mile an hour winds, which is 4-6 conditions, in order to get 5 foot waves, you have a fetch in excess of 10 miles in order to generate that with unlimited duration events in deep water. In short, and deep water would be a wavelength, one half of the wave, the length of the wave is considered deep water if the water depth exceeds one half. That means we would have to have water depths in excess of 40 feet for those waves to develop. They just aren't going to develop from those conditions. Now, I've lived here for 14 years, and I can tell you that at most we've seen 25 to 30 knot winds, maybe 35 knot winds out of the south. We just don't develop southerly winds. The hurricanes, the storms, the patterns are typical northeasters, where we have a low pressure system move up the coast and a high pressure system inland that generates the high northeast winds. We just don't get heavy southerlies. By the time we get southerlies, it's because the weather system has passed. So to suggest that these properties on these faces would see on a regular basis a 5 foot sea condition is just overstating what the truth is. A 5 foot wave condition, given the height of these properties, would mean that most of these houses along here would be gone. They would not survive. They just would not survive. They'd be knocked off their foundations. In Isabel, two of these houses out here, in fact, were knocked off their foundations from the northeast winds and had to be destroyed and rebuilt. You just don't see that kind of property destruction along here. So what I'm telling you is that there can be no denial that he is seeing some erosion here. What is not needed is the type of energy-absorbing barrier that is being proposed. A simple revetment along this shore is more than adequate to protect his property. And if you look at this photo compared against the previous photo that was shown of the property back in the 60s when this was dredged out and developed, you'd see that these property lines haven't substantially changed, except for here, where the bulk of the erosion has taken place. So he's not seeing that kind of severe erosion. Certainly there's erosion. Certainly nobody likes to see the concrete riprap that's just thrown down there. That's not the way it should be done. We know that's not the way it should be done. It should be done in a proper revetment with ground cloth and granite and whatever other materials are put in there. But that would more than adequately stabilize that property. The other thing that I would add is that we have no idea what the effect of the proposed project would be on the other properties. No idea. And not one person can come up here and tell you what the effect will be. We have sediment traps here. We know there's sediment traps. We know that those canals will address and pull in sediment. You can even see the sediment build out here, as well as the sediment build out here and the recent sediment off even my property, which is at the end of one of these canals that has developed. We put something out here. We're going to affect the current flows coming out of Cabin. We have current flows coming up Chisholm Creek, Cozen River, coming in and out of Cabin Creek. We don't know what effect that might have in the sediment transfer. So for the benefit of Mr. Trainman, and I fully agree, he needs to be able to stabilize his property. There's no question. But he shouldn't do it at the potential risk to all the rest of us. It just doesn't make any sense to do it. There is potential risk. We've already seen it from this with sediment transfer, and we just shouldn't see it there. I'll just, with the sea conditions, I'll just give you a quote from a reference. This is a document which is well known to every mariner in the world, Navy or merchant. It's from Bowditch, the American Practical Navigator.
Sure.
I'm sorry, I won't go there if that's...
I just like to make a comment. Daniel was sort of talking about Mr. Trainman's roof that may or may not be
fair enough.
I wasn't sure. This clearly is not in the record.
That's fair enough.
Thank you
very much.
Yes, sir. Next. Don't worry. It's not in the record. I won't hear from you. Fair enough? Sorry.
My name is Ken Ogren. I live at 604 York Point Road. And to reiterate much of my comment at the Wetlands Board, my concern is to put in what is in mine and the neighbor's judgment a grandiose 3/4 acre fill to solve a problem that can be done with revetment is overkill. The risk to the channel navigability, and frankly, channel navigability greatly affects the value of my property, and I somewhat care deeply about that. As an aside, if I be permitted, the testimony about sand moving requiring replacement, that was at the Yorktown waterfront, and the fact that it falls into an 80-foot deep channel may account for the fact that there's no fill, but it's taken multiple refillings to replace that sand. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. I may be one of the more lengthier ones, but I'll keep it as short as I possibly can. Eric Ancaro, 112 Creek Circle. This does work. Right there, and actually my parents live in the house beside me. I've lived at 112 for 7 years and at 110 for the 23 years prior to that. And this is really, really concerning to me. I won't dwell too much on what Mr. Barnett said. He said it more eloquently than I can, I think. But I feel that this appeal is being generated largely on what I feel is kind of a deceptive piece of legal minutia, for lack of a better way to say it. To tell the Wetlands Board they only have jurisdiction over a 10-foot wide swath, then to allow the project, if they had approved it, then they all of a sudden their jurisdiction would be 140 foot wide and would cover, as somebody else said, 2/3 to 3/4 of an acre. I don't think that's the intention, and I agree with Mr. Barnett and with the case that was stated that I think that needs to be considered. You can't look at a small piece of the puzzle and then say, oh, okay, this is what the entire thing looks like. Mr. Ong, can I put my presentation up? Oh, Commissioner, can I put my slide presentation up that I did during one of the meetings? Everything's 100% on the record.
It's for the record. I just want you to make a decision whether you chose this PowerPoint.
I will breeze through it. I really just wanted up there for a few of the guidelines for the VMRC. The statutes were spoken to, the resultant guidelines that your commission puts out, and I wanted to be able to speak to those.
In the interest of the fair hearing, please put it up.
I'll breathe still a moment.
That's fine. You can get information.
Again, we won't revisit this. We already have. Obviously, not an area of erosion. But I would like to point out that 100% of what you see in this picture would be covered with sand. I mean, there. All of the living crustaceans, everything that's in that would be covered with sand. And in my opinion, that does impact wetlands. That is part of the wetlands. That's part of y'all's jurisdiction. And in my mind, the local board as well. Again, this whole thing is predicated on these pounding wave and surf action. This is a five-night run straight through of what the truth is, what the true cross-section of this is. And it's not that substantial. We're not experiencing the waves. Mr. Van Tassel spoke to it as well, and I just wanted to reiterate it because, again, the whole presentation is predicated on it. Again, this one was really telling. We already saw it, but it's iced all the way across this area of significant fetch that we see. Yorktown doesn't ice over. Projects like VIMS are done that were spoken about earlier. They're done on York Rivers where the currents are substantial, where the wave pounding takes place. That doesn't happen here. It certainly doesn't happen in an area that's prone to icing over. This next slide, again, I thought was important. If we're talking about the environmental impact and the wetlands piece, this was a picture I snapped of a guy fishing. You can see his gill net over there on the right. He's fishing the area which would end up being Mr. Trainham's beach. And I know there's some wetland pieces to that beach, but he is fishing an area that would be taken from the private, given to the public. Rocks, filled dirt would be piled on top of what has spent 50 years becoming a stabilized environment. And again, I want to, at this point, also remind everybody on the board that the erosion we've seen in the pictures, the erosion that's happening on this property, has been doing so over 5 decades. This is not something that's happened over the last 2 or 3 years. This is 5 decades, and this is far from minimal erosion. To speak to the VMRC guidelines, the counsel for Mr. Trainham brought up the statutes and the VMRC guidelines that are a result of that. And none of it fits the guidelines that your board has established. Not justified if there's activities which can't be conducted on existing fastlands. No requirement to water access. When damage to property owners other than the current parcel were in question is a likely result. You know, this here, this is inevitable, and nobody knows what's going to happen, where that sand moves. The sand moves out into one of the channels and it has to be dredged. That does have a negative environmental impact. It destroys wetlands pieces. It destroys other portions of the environment. When there are viable alternatives, which won't destroy these natural resources, which won't destroy oyster grounds, marshes, other subterraneous habitat, again, I mean, this is minimal erosion here. The applicant, Mr. Neville, I apologize, I can't remember his last word, but he stood up and said that one of the viable alternatives, and I believe he used that exact word, one of the viable alternatives is a basic revetment. We haven't even approached that subject as the presentation never changes. The proposal has not changed yet. This is specific to your shoreline protection strategies. And again, I know y'all got a long day, so I'm not going to talk about all of it. But only justify there's active detrimental erosion. I don't think anybody in this room can say there's active detrimental erosion. That's just a farce to even believe that. This, clear and definite need to accrete beaches. It would be reckless to accrete a beach in any way on this property. That spur would begin trapping any sand that comes around from the Chesapeake Bayside. And again, I know y'all aren't as familiar with it. That spur would trap all of that. Any sand, any sediment flow. The breakwaters would continue to trap sediment flow and would begin to accrete beaches, which is in violation of your own published guidelines. You know, this next bullet point, I want to specifically show that a study of one of the county's shoreline systems showed that 50%, half of them, are having unintended consequences. We spoke to Yorktown. Mr. Cashy's property was also mentioned, which I want to note at this point is a much different scenario than this, not only from the exposure, but it didn't have breakwaters. It didn't have this amount of fill. It had one spur on each side, and that was it. It was a much different project, gentlemen. And the owner of the adjacent property is here tonight, and I believe he's going to speak. And that last sentence in that bullet point, needless shoreline modification is discouraged. This isn't even modification. It's beyond that. I mean, this is a total recreation of every portion of this parcel. I mean, this is beyond what is necessary. The placement, this one speaks exactly to it. Offshore breakwaters, submerged sills, nearshore portions of shoreline, acceptable in areas with good sand supply. There is no sand supply here. There's no sand supply. There's channels on all sides. You know, if you're on the Chesapeake Bay side, if you're in Yorktown, there's beach all along there. There's a nearshore sand supply. Not the case here at all. Insufficient. The next one's kind of a repeat, but again, if there's no sand supply, how can these be functional? That's where they function. They function in a scenario where there's pounding wave action, there's nearshore sand supplies. The next piece of this was filling. Again, these are all out of your guidelines. Encroachment behind mean high waters justified must be limited to the minimum of required to achieve the goal, which here is erosion control. And if anybody can look at this project and say, oh, yeah, this is minimalistic, I mean, that is just ridiculous to even consider this project minimalistic in any way. This will be a large this is a large project of the same scale of the one down in Yorktown. And we're talking about a much different scenario, a much different plot of land there. The background of this, again, I'm not going to get into. We've been to three meetings. Nothing's changed. Prior to that, we approached the applicant as well as his architect and said, could we please speak with you? We did, to no avail. We approached him again and said, please come out to our house and discuss some of our concerns. Again, nothing was done at all. So as much as we would all like to continue to try to approach that, we haven't been able to. We were forced to show up at the Wetlands Board meeting and speak our piece. And again, this is a lot of good people here tonight, and we have just tried our best to be reasonable. And at some point, we have to protect what's ours, because with Fayport, I've lived there every day of my life. I plan on raising my family there. We have to protect those things. I want to go back to this entire thing being predicated on the wave action. I won't. But I also want to talk about how it's predicated on its environmental merits, and it has none. It's not environmentally sensitive to dump somewhere between 800 and 1,100 truckloads of sand past the mean low water line covering this much property. You have that many truckloads, 1,000, 1,100, however many it turns out to be, dumping sand. You've got bulldozers. You've got backhoes. You've got all of these things operating not only within the RPA but beyond it. And yet we're going to sit here and say this is environmentally sensitive? I mean, the amount of hydraulic fluid and oil and diesel fumes and all those environmentally negative pieces are going to be... I'm the youngest person in this room, and I'll be dead before any of that damage is done.
That's speculative. Okay.
No problem. I want to approach the precedent here because this is real dangerous. If we allow everybody up and down Chisholm Creek to do this, up and down the Pocosin River, we're going to end up with a sandbox, a big one. And that's what our concerns are. And I think in that matter, this calls for conservatism, as everything with our waterways, I think, should. Randy, I don't have it, but it's been up there several times, the aerial shot. There are several other pieces there with the exact same exposure. The piece at the end of the next, as you know, there's the three canals. And all of those other properties at the end of Creek Circle and at the end of Chisholm Creek Road have the exact same exposure. And those are even more sensitive because they have channels right in front of them. And yet they're all done with this basic pervasive preventative. That's the minimum required to do it. It's proven. It's the proof's in the pudding right there on those next two roads. I want to just make sure we all know that this doesn't stop erosion. It creates erosion into our channels. Ultimately, again, that's going to have a negative environmental impact. It's going to have a negative impact to everybody. And all this proposal really does is create a beach for a private resident. And I hope that you won't jeopardize all of our lives by either upholding this appeal or in any way approving a project of this specter. It's inappropriate. And I would, excuse the play on words here, but we'd all have to have our heads buried in the sand to not see that this is not necessary for this. I hope there's no political or external pressures at play here. And I'm just begging you, don't undermine the authority of the local boards, the authority you've given them. Don't undermine the decision of the county, and don't undermine the voice of the people, because unfortunately we're the ones that have to deal with the repercussions, both financially and emotionally and in all other manners of our life.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Who's next? Make the record, please.
My name is Anthony DeLisa. Just quickly to introduce myself, I am an engineer. There was some question about scientific information being presented. In addition to being a resident of this nearby property for several years. Excuse me, I'm going to go ahead and put a...
Could you say your name again,
sir? Anthony Beluso. Can we put up the aerial shot, please? Just one of the areas. One of the first things I wanted to address was a question I believe Mr. Schick asked of Mr. Owen. That's perfect. The question was about the revised proposal, and a comment was made that whether or not the changes were significant. I wanted to point out that what Mr. Owen answered with was misleading and incorrect. The proposal that Mr. Owen showed on the slide that was somewhat significant, was a change, was not what they came to the board meeting with. The last board meeting, they came with a proposal that was almost identical with only minor changes. The slide that Mr. Owen showed was only presented in the last 5 minutes of the last board meeting. Could you put this up so we can clarify this issue?
Mr. Little can answer that question. It's his design.
I just didn't want the commission to be misled. Right. This is what was presented in the last 10 minutes or 5 minutes of the meeting. This is not what they had brought to the meeting. I wanted to be clear about that.
Okay.
Because this is a change compared to what they had brought to the meeting before. Okay. Okay. So a couple of points I wanted to discuss. I think what this really amounts to, it amounts to risk. It amounts to the question of criteria one that the local board considered, whether the public and private benefit exceed the detriment. I think the local board considered that carefully, and I think their decision supports the fact that they do not believe that the public private benefit for this project exceeds the detriment. I think the record, reviewing the record, I think it clearly shows that they considered this issue. It is unfortunate that in their final resolution that they didn't specifically cite it, but I think, as Mr. Barnett said, it's almost implied. I think but to speak to this point about the public-private benefit exceeding the detriment, I really haven't heard any real scientific analysis of this point, if we're speaking on scientific data. I have heard that several organizations, VIMS and SEAS, they agree with this living shoreline approach, and they feel that it is positive. But I don't believe that VIMS and SEAS are considering the specifics of this particular shoreline, this particular area. I think that is what the purpose of the local wetlands board, the local board, is to do, is to take the input of these other organizations, which like the approach, and consider the factors of the current of the proposed location. I think a living shoreline would be a great thing to have in many areas. The question again is it appropriate in this location with the sensitivity of this navigation channel, the wetlands areas in this area and over here? Is it appropriate? And I think the local board has spoken on that. I think and I think we should uphold that decision. To speak to the potential detriment, I said it in the meeting before, and I'll say it again. The project at Yorktown, which was developed by the same engineering firm that has worked on this proposal, last year, 38 tandem loads worth of sand had to be replenished into that area. It has very similar spurs. The construction elements at Yorktown are very similar, and the engineering firm that has proposed this project has said themselves that, you know, you can't really guarantee what's going to happen. There are best practices. They believe they're following them, but even still, we're losing sand at Yorktown. Now, what detrimental effect is 1,000 dump truck loads of fill material going to have on the surrounding area? I think the local board considered that, and they spoke. They said that the potential benefit of creating this area of wetland does not exceed the potential damage that could occur from that sand moving around. We talked about the Cashy project at the end. I think it's extremely important to note when discussing other projects that have been approved, other similar projects, the question has been asked. The local board has approved other similar projects in other areas. Why didn't they approve this one? It's extremely important to note the fetch and note the northeast exposure. This project right here needs some significant measures. This project is vastly different due to its northeast exposure. It's also important to note, as I think has already been mentioned, is that the average depth in this area is very low, especially right in this area. You can see this big sandbar. The waves that can develop and pass this bar to strike the land, the bar reduces the wave heights by virtue of the fact that it's shallow. The wave cannot develop the wave height. It protects these shorelines. And I think if we were seeing the moderate energy shoreline that the engineering firm has said that exists here due to their tables, these houses, we would be seeing much more damage in these areas. This shoreline and this shoreline is protected with the revetment. And they have been effective since this area was dredged and houses were put there. To say that something as significant as being proposed here is necessary, I think you can, I mean, just by looking at this picture and seeing that these houses still exist and that these erosion control measures here have been met, that it's clear that what is being proposed is not necessary. Now, I think it would be nice if we could build a living shoreline. I think, as VIMS has stated and some of the other firms have stated, that is a preferred approach. But I think in this specific case, we have to look at the potential damage that can occur from it, and the potential damage is significant. I wanted to address a question from Mr. Schick asking about a revetment could cause... basically, the gist of the question was, is that if, as opposed to a living shoreline, a revetment could create more energy that could impact the surrounding areas more significantly as opposed to a living shoreline. And kind of my comment to that is there is a revetment there already. So to put a revetment back, it doesn't really – that's maintaining the status quo. I don't see how you could have significantly more energy when that's the situation we have now. Let me see what other points that I want to make. I think it's important to note that there was some question in the local board meetings, and I've heard it discussed here today, about whether erosion is occurring. I think it's clear from the pictures we can see that there is some erosion occurring. And I don't think there is any question about whether or not measures should be taken to control that erosion. But I do want to make the point that, as you saw in the pictures, the erosion, the revetment that was constructed was improperly constructed. It was basically dumped construction materials. And after the 50 years that this property has been here with an improperly constructed revetment, to only see the erosion that we've seen so far, I think also speaks to the point that we're not seeing massive waves, we're not seeing massive amounts of erosion that warrant such a such a large-scale project.
Sir, can you try to wrap it up so we can hear from the rest of the folks?
I will do so, yes, sir.
Thank you.
The last thing I wanted to do is read a couple points in a letter that I had written to Mr. Owen. I have several concerns about this application, and I was hoping you could shed some light, again, to address Mr. Owen. On the issue. In summary, my concerns are, what effect will the shoreline erosion measures described in the application have on the navigability of the adjacent channel, and what effects will the spur indicated have on the wave action that impacts my property immediately across my channel? That's, I think, a concern that hasn't been discussed much, but with the spur that they're suggesting to be constructed, what will happen when incident waves strike it and reflect into my property? I haven't heard much discussion about that, and my concern is that this construction that will be done here will negatively affect my shoreline control measures and will require me to then to make additional changes. And that's a large concern.
Did you bring that issue up in the Wetlands Board?
I did, yes, sir. I brought it up, and I haven't heard any discussion from the applicant on that issue. So, just to continue. Regarding my first concern, the dredge channel and currently implemented shoreline control measures have been in place undisturbed for a long time. I'm concerned that making such a major change to the shoreline may have unintended negative impacts on the dredge channel. More specifically, I'm concerned that the current channel will be destabilized by either the construction or by the new structures and cause shoaling, which will reduce the navigability. What analysis has been done to ensure that the channel will not shoal as a result of the construction? And I really haven't seen much. All I've seen is that the applicant has said we've built these before and we don't lose sand, which the example of Yorktown, I think, refutes that statement. If the currently proposed measures are implemented, what happens if the future hypothetical channel does show as a result of the change? Do I have a recourse in this situation? And is there a mechanism by which the developer of the property will pay to repair the damages to the navigable channel as a result of the construction? My second concern is about the wave action incident on my pier and shoreline adjacent to the construction. Having lived in my location for several years, I am familiar with the wave action and various weather conditions that affect my boats, piers, and shoreline, and I'm familiar with and can manage the current wave action. My concern is that the proposed structures could increase the wave action seen at my pier, making the pier unusable, or that the increased wave action will have a detrimental effect on my property's shoreline erosion control measures. The structure that gives me pause is the curved 164-foot spur referenced in the proposal. Could that structure cause a focusing wave action into the channel and cause more detrimental effects to my property? My final concern is regarding the necessity of such a large change to the shoreline with all the concerns and unknowns it causes. It seems that the current shoreline control measures have been at least moderately effective. Why now does such a drastic measure need to be taken as opposed to something more moderate? In other words, are the benefits of such a change worth the possible risks and unintended damages that could result? I would ask the commission to let the local board's decision stand. I think that the issue of jurisdiction has been adequately addressed. I think if the local board can't look holistically at the project, then what's the point? I think Mr. Barnett has addressed that issue, and I won't further discuss it. The final point that I would like to leave you with is I think the local board ruled that the public-private benefit of the project does not exceed the detriment, and I believe they ruled fairly and correctly, and I would like you to uphold their decision. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Who's next?
My name is Scott Salter. I live at 710 York Point Road, about three houses up Cabin Creek from where the Mr. Train's property is. I'll be brief. You've heard it from everyone else. This is a matter of grave concern to the people that use Cabin Creek to get out into the bay. A couple of the points that I simply want to reiterate that were in my protest letter was residents that have lived there for decades have said through the protest letters that this property has not changed, even with the obsolete type of revetment that it has around it. It hasn't changed. All Mr. Trader needs to do is take out all of the inappropriate concrete and material that's down there and put in the bluestone riprap, and it will be protected, and he will have the opportunity to build the house he wants to build and live there. And by taking that approach, it won't put my property at risk and my ability to get out through Cabin Creek. On the face of it, this is a project to build a beach for one man, and it puts all of the other adjacent properties at risk. And we have heard it over and over again this morning. And you can just picture where Cabin Creek makes that little turn there when you dump 1,000 truckloads of sand right in front of the entrance to Cabin Creek. It's going to block it off. It'll turn it into Cabin Lake. And where do we go at that point? Who do we turn to? This is our opportunity to be heard, and we're asking this committee to uphold the rule of the county and not simply dismiss it out of hand as an arbitrary decision. It really wasn't. There's hundreds of pages of material that was submitted regarding this project. The last point is you can pay anybody to say anything you want in a study. And we have, Mr. Tradem's developer is indicated that this is going to be wonderful for the environment. But common sense would say dumping 1,000 truckloads of dirt and sand into the Chesapeake Bay is not good for the environment. So I'll end it there and just reiterate how important this is to everybody that lives in the area. And we feel like our lifestyle and our properties are at risk if the project gets approved as is, when there is a readily available, simple solution. Just replace the bluestone revetment around it, and that property will do well for however long the situation stay the way it is. It's a very simple solution that takes care of his interest, and it takes care of the interest of all the neighbors. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Next.
My name name's Tim Gellis. I live at 612 York Point Road, which is really up Cabin Creek, up the creek, so to say. The only point I really want to make, and I had to make it at the Wetlands Board meeting as well, is the sensitivity around water depth. We're not talking about a 60-foot deep channel here. When I go in and out with my boat, it's only about 36 inches deep at low tide. So it doesn't take a lot of sand migration to make that an accessible channel at low tide. I mean, 8 or 12 inches of sand would make it, you know, inaccessible for me to get home at low tide. So I don't know whether anybody realized how shallow that channel already is, and it wouldn't take much to jeopardize it. That's really the only point I wanted to make.
Thank you, sir. Anyone else? Good morning, sir.
Good morning. My name is Frank Ankara. I live at 110 Creek Circle, which is almost directly across from the property. So I've been in a position to deserve that piece of property for since 1977. What is that? In excess of 30 years. I'm a little bit disappointed. As much as I hate public speaking, I've spent a considerable amount of time preparing a presentation for today. But I feel like we're wearing out our welcome, and if anything, I stand the chance of losing y'all's interest. So I'm going to be very brief. Most of what I would reiterate has been said. This meeting, in my mind, got off to a little bit slow start. I felt like Mr. Trainum's attorney enjoyed the luxury of speaking as long as he felt like he needed to. I felt like I had called Randy Owen prior to this meeting and advised everybody that we were to stick to the original presentation, and I was very careful to prepare mine accordingly. I felt like Mr. Trainum's attorney strayed from that at the very beginning and sort of set the stage for this hearing, which hopefully we've been able to correct some. Just let me say in summary, I think the Wetlands Board did the right thing. They heard an awful lot of testimony that y'all will not have the chance to hear today. And they heard it from an awful lot of good people who lived in that area a long time, and it makes sense. Again, I'm not even going to refer to my notes. Several of the things that Mr. Neville has said about it's been discussed over and over, so I won't dwell on it. The sea state there and the amount of damage it's done by erosion. Again, I watched that piece of property for 30 years, and has been said it's been very poorly protected with nothing in the world but slabs of concrete, and it has maintained itself very, very well for those 30 years in spite of that. You've got two identical pieces of property that have suffered no erosion, and they have just a simple revetment process. Mr. Owen, could you put up the slide of mine? It's part of the record. It's the one taken during the hurricane. It's been said over and over about the prevailing winds, about the fact that sandbars could break any wave action, about the length of the fetch. This was a picture taken approximately 2 hours before high tide during the middle of the 3-day storm in November. And if you had gotten in your car and driven over to the other side of York Point or any of the north or northeast exposure, at that time you would have seen pounding surf, these 5 waves that Neville claims were subject to, and you would have seen the wind conditions, you would have seen damaging surf. This is what it looked like during the middle of Norida. This was roughly the middle of the 2 or 3 day blow when the winds were probably at their most. And I know the picture's not clear, but basically you see high water, and that's all you see. And that's all you'll ever see in a major storm. The storms that cause damage in this area come, as has been said over and over again, from the northeast. Worst that comes from that exposure is an occasional thunderstorm that blows through and is come and gone probably in 20 minutes. Well, I will really have to cut things short, for I forgot my glasses. Can I go back and get my glasses 1 second?
He's bringing
Frank.
Like I said, most of what I would say has probably been said. I would like to point out one thing. This massive undertaking, is we feel it is, I don't know what the stakes are that have been placed there. I've been looking at those stakes for 6 months, but they don't begin to describe the scale and the mass of this project. My lot on York Point is 140 feet deep. When I stand in my lot in the middle of it, look in both directions and imagine breakwaters extending out 140 feet into that water with rocks weighing thousands of pounds piled up 5 feet high, I can't imagine. I can't imagine why y'all would approve it. The risk of the sand being displaced has been talked about over and over, and it's a sincere concern that we all have, and the Wetlands Board heard it. I did something that maybe hasn't been touched on. There are requirements also mentioned in the Chesapeake Bay Preservation Act. And I don't think that these have been touched on, but I'll quote them. Any proposed shoreline erosion control measures are necessary and consistent with the nature of the erosion occurring at the site. I hope we've been successful in convincing y'all that that breakwater system is not necessary and consistent. Chesapeake Bay Preservation Act says that proposed land disturbance has been minimized. I think there's been enough here to say that the truck traffic and the barge traffic and the placement of all those stones and sand will not minimize land disturbance. And the third thing the Chesapeake Bay Preservation Act says is that the project is consistent with the locality's comprehensive plan. I know y'all say you've approved several of these breakwater projects, but again, I think breakwater projects need to be site-specific. But the proposed development is far in excess of what other property owners have been allowed to do or have been told they would allow to do to protect their property from erosion. And that doesn't just come from local people. There have been several people that spoke, and I don't know if any of them will have time to speak here today. We've had personal experiences with breakwater projects, erosion control projects that have gone wrong and caused significant damage to their property, loss of property value, that they have to personally financially recover from. And that could happen here. That has been talked about over and over again. There were a few other things that I took some notes. I'm not sure I can read them. I agree with what Anthony Vavuso got up here and said. The applicant had an original proposal that was first shown back in December of 08. My son mentioned that we met with him and expressed our concerns, invited him out to our house to walk the property and see what our concerns were. And he did that, and he seemed sort of reassuring that he would work with his design engineer and make some changes. The changes he made to one of the far spurs were so slight that you have to overlay them on a light table to see the differences. When he shelved the project at the December meeting, unexpectedly, the agreement was that when they showed up 2 weeks prior to the February meeting, if there was a revision to the application, it would be posted. And that didn't happen. Ms. Drake called the applicant and said it was unchanged. So the second submittal that has been shown several times was put up at the very end of the Wetlands Board hearing, in my mind, was not part of the application. It was put up there at the end as a, well, will you accept this? So I think that needs to be talked about, whether or not that was even part of the application process. Mr. Schick, you asked a question. I'll read it if I can find that paragraph. Although there's a general discussion of prevailing conditions at the site, in the entire 36-page application, there is no substantive analysis, calculation, or engineering evidence to justify or guarantee the long-term success of this project. And I think we've all said that these things are, yes, they're recommended by VIMS. We all say they need to be site-specific, and this proposal is not specific to this site for all the reasons we've tried to outline. It's been brought up. My son has a couple slides showing the type of bottom that's out there. It's been mentioned several times. That's not a sandy bottom that will support a breakwater system. I think it's been made point of over and over again, and you would have to agree that the first criteria about public benefit versus public detriment is overwhelming the evidence that this stands a better chance of being a detriment to the public than it does a benefit. If you look at those drawings and scale off the amount of wetlands, beach nourishment area, whatever you want to call it, that would be generated, if that's the part that's being generated for the public, there's no way in the world that offsets the risk involved. I'll probably end it there. I think some of the other criteria is Mr. Trainum's pointed out. I think all three of the criteria that he said had been met. I thought he was actually pretty successful in arguing that they haven't been met, not that they have been met. I think one of them was public benefit versus public detriment, necessary to protect property, if that was the second one, and consistent with the intent. I'm not sure either any of those three criteria have been met. We live down there because we love that area, and we want to protect that area. There's not a single person that's here today from that area that doesn't want to protect that area and do the right thing. But that breakwater system is not the right thing. And I'll conclude there, and I think this may be one of two other people that would like to speak.
Thanks.
My name is Elise Pye. I live at 114 Creek Circle. I know that you guys have heard a lot of talking, and it seems as though we're wearing out our welcome, as has already been said. I live... Yes?
Where did you get that perception?
I just can tell on the faces. It seemed you were very intent on listening to the first few speakers, but as it goes on, it just seems as there's some heads going back, and it just seems like we're very much tiring you. So I would like to just keep it...
Everything that you've got to say is very important.
Just a couple of really quick things. It's all on the record what I've said before. Mr. Schick, you directly asked if any of the people that spoke had actual scientific expertise or information when we were presenting at the last meetings, the three or four meetings. And no, we don't necessarily have letters behind our names, but we have gone ballot with the scientific method, but we all live there. We've all been there through storms. My house in particular backs up to the revetment. It is very close to the water. If you look at the aerial photo, there's absolutely no way that our house would be standing if we had 5-foot waves with a 6-foot tidal surge above that. The southwesterly winds, I brought up the point that when we have those southwesterly winds, so the water gets drawn out of the creek, and one of the wetland board's members did address that, and they said that based on the flow of the Pocosin River and the Chisholm Creek, the water is blown out of the creek, so we have virtually no water there during the southwesterly, a 30-mile-an-hour or 40-knot southwesterly wind, because anything westerly blows the water out. Again, I mean, I'm not VIMS, I'm not any of these other places. However, I'm there every day. I've been there during NORIDA. I've been there during several. We had a foot of water in our garage, and we didn't have any wind damage. It just was the water came up, and the water went down. It wasn't wave action. It's just we live there, and it would make all of us feel like maybe that was taken into consideration, that we did feel important, that we are the ones that are living there, that we are the ones that have the actual observations, even though we don't have the letters to support it behind our name.
Thank you, ma'am. Next. Okay, Mr. Daniel, you've got a few minutes to wrap this up. Rebuttal, please.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. We will wrap up very quickly. There have been a number of comments on technical issues, and I'm going to ask Mr. Reynolds to come forward and address a few of those in about 3 minutes.
I'd be fine. You've been previously sworn, and you're under oath.
Thank you. Try to make a couple of comments that are all in the previous records to put this back into context. There were some comments made about this whole project being predicated on pounding wave action. There's been discussion about the fact that there's no erosion on the site. I think we've seen evidence that there is, in fact, erosion at the site. When we entered into this project, the ultimate goal was to protect the shoreline and to restore a more natural edge to this piece of property. That's consistent with the guidelines. We followed the typical course of design. The configuration of the system, there was some comment about it being minimalistic. We never made any representations that this was minimalistic. We've been guided through the process to establish a living shoreline, if one could be established here. As Randy showed, this entire parcel, not just the Trainums, but the surrounding land, has been forced into the landscape. Has hard edges, canals that have been man-made. The idea here was to restore a more natural estuarine edge at this property. In order to do that, you have to establish dissipative slopes, and you have to establish planting mediums. That's where the fill comes in. The rock structures. There's been comment about the 5-foot waves on the site. In retrospect, I regret having cited that wave height came directly from a Basco and Shin document, 1993, design wave information for Chesapeake Bay and major tributaries for moderate energy shorelines, high and moderately energy shorelines, which this qualifies for. The structures in themselves, this system, when we developed it, We developed it with many of the concerns that the opposition has in mind. We have Mr. Trainum has as much interest in the navigability in these channels, both in Cabin Creek and the adjacent man-made channel, as his property adjacent property owners do. So we created a more closed system. The typical relationship between the bay gap, between the bay depth. And the gap between the structures is on the order of 1-to-1, which is very conservative. The purpose of that was to maintain those pocket beaches, to hold the sand within the structures. There's also been a lot of discussion about the circumstances of the revised proposal. That proposal was not presented to the board as another option or for them to take action on. There was discussion at the end of the public hearing about alternatives, alternative living approaches. I had developed that concept just to see what it would look like. In the end, we decided it did not address many of the objections of the property owners. It still had sand fill. It still had substantial rock structures. Those things are necessary for a living shoreline approach. And the only reason we showed it at the hearing is because there was a debate about the design and what other things might be appropriate here. At the board's request, I had that slide put up, as the opposition has said, at the very end of the hearing to demonstrate those very factors, that if you're going to have a living shoreline, you're going to have fill as a planting medium, and you're going to have, depending on the wave climate, and particularly even with this wave climate here,
you're going to have some rock, you're going to have rock structures to retain that fill and to allow the vegetation to become established and sustain the plan forms over time. As I believe you saw in the record, and you could tell from the presentation that Randy went through and some of the comments from the opposition, a revetment is certainly an option here. It's certainly an option that we considered. It's an option that we discussed with the regulatory agencies and the advisory agencies prior to submitting a permit application. At that time, we were advised that a straight revetment would not likely be approved here because of the guidance and the tendency to push towards a living shoreline approach. That's the direction that we went. When we considered coming back to the board with a revised decision, with a revised plan, and we considered what the elements of that revised plan might look like, living shoreline, sand and rock material, or a revetment, we decided that we had gone through the process, the system has directed us or has guided us toward a living shoreline approach. We provided a very viable design. There are folks here in the office, in the audience from BIMS that can comment on the designs. They're all around Chesapeake Bay. The character of this project is in the same context as those, is in the same character of those for similar situations. And for us to, I think, as you've heard from the comments and in the record, an alternative design presented to the board of that time that would have been acceptable at that time, and this came out at the end, would have been a revetment. Since we felt like and we believe that we've gone through the process and we followed the appropriate design parameters, we decided to let the process run its course. Mr. Trainum's gone through the process correctly. We've gone through it. We've gotten guidance. We came up with an acceptable design, and weren't inclined to change that design to a revetment or a non-living shoreline approach based on adjacent property owner opposition. We're confident in the design. We feel like it is appropriate at this property. Anything out there is forced. The wood walls and the canals are forced. The revetments on the outside shorelines is forced. The very land itself is forced into the landscape. You have an opportunity here. Mr. Trainum has the resources to establish marsh and dune habitat here, and we feel like it's an appropriate proposal under the Wetlands Act.
Thank you. Questions or comments? I'm sorry, Mr. Robbins. Mr. Robbins has a question for you, sir.
I do have one question just to follow up here, Mr. Reynolds, and if you could keep your response to information that's contained in the record. But in the minutes of the February meeting, we talked about there were three ways that sand can be lost, so longshore transport, crossshore transport, and overtopping. And obviously the site has ongoing erosion happening, given the state of the existing revetment. But can you comment briefly on how the spur factors into the design to address those issues?
Yes, the project as laid out creates two pocket beaches, and the position of the breakwaters and the spurs allow those pocket beaches to reside in there in a stable configuration. As waves come in between the structures, they're refracted or defracted at the structures, which bends the wave, and the breaker angle within those pocket beaches becomes zero around the embayment. And when you have a breaker angle of zero, there is no longshore sediment transport. As far as crossshore sediment transport or transport into the backshore, during storm events, and again, I want to stress that we've seen some pictures of the site during northeastern events and during quiet events. The system is designed for major storm events, primarily hurricanes that move through the area and could conceivably come up the Pocosin River and put wave attack on the shoreline. During those high water events, you could get some overtopping and sand moving up over the back of the system. In that case, you're actually going to end up with probably a nicer, softer edge along this man-made shoreline, which we think it would actually be beneficial. The sand size that we would specify for this site is 0.6 millimeters. The beach slopes that are within the embayments themselves and the berm that's in there will very much limit the loss of sand in the offshore direction. It allows percolation and dissipation of that wave energy across the beach face.
Thanks. Further questions? Thank you. Do you have any further, Mr. Daniel?
Real quickly, Mr.
2 minutes, please, if you would.
Yes, sir. With respect to the opinion of General Blaws in 1984, know a little bit about that opinion, having been the senior assistant at the time and to remember the discussions before that opinion was issued. In no way do I want to leave you with the opinion that opinion ceded any of the jurisdiction of this commission to a local wetland board. That simply is not the state of that opinion, nor whatever value the opinion may be given with respect to legal weight, true with respect to the opinion. And finally, you all have heard the testimony of the protestants. You've heard the testimony of the Wetland Board. I would just simply call your attention to your own staff report on page 3 as they do the analysis of the criteria under 1302. They've done that for you. I did it for you as best I could. I commend Mr. Owens to you and his comments there, and renew the request on behalf of Mr. Trainum that you all reverse the decision of the local wetlands board. You see the atmosphere. This won't change if we go back on a remand to that board. It's properly before you, and I have expressed to you in my opening comments the basis upon which, under 1313, you're entitled to make a decision of reversal. I appreciate all the time you all have given to this morning, and thank you very much for your consideration.
Mr. Schick has a question.
I just wanted to reiterate and to make sure that the Attorney General's opinion really states that the whole project can be looked at as it refers to wetlands.
It says, that obviously, and I think Mr. Barnett made a good point, although there is a little bit of mental gymnastics that have to go on in this, you clearly can look at the length of a groin or a structure that sits within the purview and the jurisdiction of this commission. But you have to then make the correlation between that structure and the actual what goes on in the case of the wetlands, and then you in fact have to make that connection on your record. That's the absence here.
Matters before the commission for discussion and action. Mr. Schick.
I have one question for Mr. Owens. These man-made channels, have they been hardened, or are they all riprapped or bulkhead or both? Or
both, and I could look at the right button here. There's a considerable amount of riprap and bulkhead in those canals. In fact, that's what the protestants argued, was that that's what's been used to protect these areas. That's what should be used now.
And so there's very little wetlands as far as vegetated wetlands, if any.
Yeah, most of those canals are fairly deep, and the water's right up against bulkheads.
Further questions? Comments?
Well, I have some comments. I've just reading through the minutes, listening to everybody speak here tonight, some very valid issues were brought up, whether they should have been brought up at the Wetlands Board, that's the question. A lot of those issues are for this board to look at, as opposed to the Wetlands Board. I don't see where the Wetlands Board made their decision based on engineering or scientific fact dealing with the actual
zone that they're assigned to analyze. I'm not saying that the issues that were brought before us today and at the Wetlands Board by the public don't have merit. I just don't think they relate to the decision upon the Wetlands Board. In my opinion, that the board can look at total projects and should look at the total projects as it affects the area of their concern. And that is was denoted in those photographs between the yellow lines. And it is a small area in this case as opposed to the overall project. Navigation issues, Sewakui's land issues, those are issues that we need to discuss when it comes before us in the right manner. So therefore, I move that we consider all of the evidence that was brought before us today, and along with staff and whatnot, and based on 28.2-1313, 1 and 2, E and F, arbitrary, not necessarily capricious, as was mentioned before, decisions were taken here. Evidence not in fact, fact not in evidence, were precluded in this case, and I feel that we should, as opposed to staff's recommendation, remand, I think we should reverse the decision.
There's a second to the motion?
I second it.
Second by Mr. Holland. Further discussion at this point. Mr. Robbins. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Mr. Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As has already been suggested, I think some of the concerns that were brought before the Wetlands Board certainly had merit. Just from a practical standpoint, if I lived in the area on the water, I'd certainly be concerned about any potential impacts to the channels. But I think it is fair to raise some concern about the jurisdictional distinctions here, because looking back at the 1984 opinion, I think the considerations do have to tie back eventually to wetlands impacts, and I think some of those concerns fall outside of that. Nevertheless, I don't think the decision has to be based on jurisdictional considerations. I think it's been suggested in the record that somehow this was not developed in a site-specific sense, that it's not appropriate for the site. I think board members suggested that there were concerns about the scale of the project, but frankly, there's been a tremendous evolution in shoreline protection strategies over the last 20 or 30 years, and so what we have now is a proposal that is inevitably going to have a larger footprint if it is in fact going to incorporate a living shoreline strategy. And so, as I see it, the applicant's gone to great lengths through the course of engaging their consultant and consulting with VIMS and the SEAS program and getting the absolute state of the science and best advice they could in terms of developing an appropriate project for the site. And by design, it's been designed, as is indicated in the record, to address the concerns about longshore and offshore movement of sand, which appears to be the overarching concern. I think the single most compelling concern that we've heard from the public is about the potential movement of sand at the project site, but I think the very design that's been brought forward has been designed to address those concerns. They were incorporated. So, and the record also uses examples such as the Cashy project to suggest that this won't be appropriate at the site, but I think that's comparing apples and oranges, because the Cashy project's unvegetated and it is exposed to a northeast fetch. So the sites are different, but I think those comparisons are really perhaps not appropriate. So I think after looking at all the evidence that what happened here is that the when you look at 28.2.1302.10b, which says that the board shall grant the permit if all those factors are met, the first factor suggests that the anticipated public and private benefit of the proposed activity exceeds its anticipated public and private detriment. I think the board substituted and somewhat commingled public opposition with public detriment. I think the public detriment here was speculative, and I think
the evidence in the record suggests that the best available science that was brought into the process through consultation with VIMS and C's and the professional engineers would suggest that this will not result in significant impacts to the waterways or marine habitat. So, again, I think the evidence, I think the decision is unsupported by the evidence on the record, as Mr. Schick has pointed out in 28.2-1313, and I'll support the motion.
Further comment? Mr. Lane?
It appears to me that maybe the Wetlands Board made the right decision, but failed to really articulate it well. There's been a lot of evidence that particularly the DIMS report that indicated that this structure would be appropriate for a low energy situation, for a higher energy situation. Now we have a lower energy situation. We're unlikely to have waves of 5 feet or any substantial waves in the area. So there's also testimony from property owners to indicate that they have had filling of the sand drifting and filling in their dock areas on their properties already, and the effect of a lot more sand in the area certainly would not have any beneficial effect on adjacent property owners. May well have a detrimental effect on them. And two, there's an alternative available, a structure that VIMS implies might be more appropriate to the situation and perhaps would not cause detrimental effect to adjacent property owners. Anyhow.
Dr. McConaughey?
Well, I would just say that I agree with Mr. Robbins that, you know, hard stabilization was the method that we've been applying for many years, but it often fails. It's not. It often causes more trouble or more problems down the road, and that to produce a natural shoreline is probably a better approach. It's now at the point where these can be engineered to be successful, and that a natural shoreline should be considered as a better alternative.
Mr. Tiger?
I would like to say that in my mind, I certainly sympathize with the citizens of the area. They live in an area that has been dredged, and their access to the bay is dependent on a dredged canal. And so I think they are right in their concerns that this overboarding of sand could limit their access to the bay. But given that the science and the scientific community disagrees with them, it brings us to the point that the applicant has followed the policy, the advice of science, but yet public perception differs. So should we base our decision on public perception or science? And I'm afraid I'd have to lean towards science.
Further comment? Well, that's similar to the exact opening remarks that I had when I took over as chairman, Mr. Tankard, almost 4 years ago. I'm very cautious in how we pick and choose when we decide to apply the science versus ignoring the science when it becomes convenient or not convenient or inconvenient. So for that reason, I support the motion. Further comment?
All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
Yeah.
Motion carries. Thank you very much for the presentation. We will take one other item before lunch.